is Karina Wynne-Moyland from Bay FM, and we're talking to Peter Carey this morning. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
And look, you've flown all the way from where to be here?
Well, from New York, really.
Yeah. Which is your home now permanently, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Look, we'll get to your latest book, which is The Chemistry of Tears, really soon. But first, I want to talk to you about how it feels to be at this stage of your career as an author, with so much success behind you, but continuing to find new and extraordinary books to churn out. Do you find sometimes that you feel that there's more pressure the more successful you've become?
Well, no. I mean, people often ask that, you know, aren't you in competition with yourself? But I think the projects that I take on, the things that interest me, are always sort of at once really interesting but inherently scary for me. And so the problem that I face, the fear, if you like, that I face of it is to do with making the book work. And that's so far beyond the issue of how it's going to be received. It's not like I don't care. I know I want people to like it in the end, but actually just to make the thing work so it can get to a stage where people can read it. That's the scary part. I've only ever been interested in writing about things that I didn't quite know how to do, because that's what's sort of good about a novel. It's sort of like you don't know the answer when you set off. You don't know the people when you set off. You just have an idea. And a book written a long time ago now, like Oscar and Lucinda, it's a love story about two people. What people, the readers, remember are the people and what happened to them.
But and the glass church.
And the glass church. But at the beginning, I start well before that. And by the end, I've never met Oscar and I've never met Lucinda and I've never lived in the 19th century and I didn't really want to. But the idea leads me there. And so that's the sort of anxiety, the fear, the terror of the book is that you don't know these things and yet you've got to find a way to know them. And at the end of it, you're going to have these people who you've made who are sort of, even to the author in a way, a sort of a miracle, because you know, I guess, that they've been made of all sorts of different forces and experiences.
Well, in The Chemistry of Tears, our protagonist lives in a very unusual world, the world, the rarefied museum world. Now, is this something that you experienced yourself through somebody else's experience, or did you have to start cold on this and absolutely learn from the ground up about what it's like to be in this world?
Yeah, I did have to, and that's one of those scary things, I guess. I mean, for various reasons, which we can't go on into now, but I did decide that Catherine would work as a somebody who was going to restore a 19th century automaton, a sort of what is finally a really exquisite silver swan that moves, is driven by clockwork to move in really beautiful and extraordinary ways. And it's her job, although she doesn't want it, to restore it. So just taking that part of things. I know nothing about clocks. I know nothing about automaton. And yet for my book to work, I've got to know what she's going to do every day. You know, what's a good day? What's a bad day? What have you got to do? How do you put it? And what's the world of a London, Grand London Museum like? And what are the social issues within the museum? So all those things I've got to find out about. And I like doing that. And in the end, it works. I mean, I've written something that a real life horologist or in a museum can read and know is pretty right.
Can we take it as gospel, sort of the little sort of secret things in the internecine wars and protocols that go on within the museum, that they're based on the sorts of things you experienced with people that you found in that world?
I spend a lot of time sort of figuring out what were the protocols within a museum and who had to approve this and how does the budget work. And so I sort of get a sense of the social work world of the museum and how it works. And then, of course, I've got my characters, and I know what they need to do. And then I sort of have to. Then I see how the rigmaroles and the rules will interfere with what they want to do. And out of that comes sort of some sense of some part of the drama of the book.
There's also a parallel story with this, of course, which is the story of the original creator of the automaton, which is, and this is a very specialised area of. You know, clockwork and little models and things. There was quite a craze for these things in the 18th century, wasn't there?
Yeah, and 19th too. Yeah, yes, absolutely was. I mean, what I was first attracted to was reading about this guy Vaucasson, who made a duck,
In fact, my character goes out, Henry, the English guy, goes out looking for to have one of these ducks made. And Vaucasson's duck was, he made all sorts of amazing sort of knitting machines and things that if you go to an industrial museum in Paris, you can see very serious bits of equipment that he made. But he also made this duck, which was a very popular among the aristocracy in Paris and I think in France generally, a duck that could move its feathers and move and could eat and ingest this sort of grain and appeared to excrete as well. And it was a, you know, this might sound vulgar, but it was a high society sort of amusement, and it was very celebrated. But of course it was totally a fake. I mean, the notion was that he'd actually sort of mechanically made life, because I guess if you, you know, you eat your shit, you die, you know. So he'd made a duck that would do this. And I was really, and it was sort of comical too. There was a cross-section of the machine, of the duck, with all of its mechanical things inside it. And I thought it was sort of funny. And I thought, oh, this is my sort of thing. I can work with this. And then as I started to research it, the really interesting thing about the duck is that it really didn't last as long as its inventor. You know, if you think of somebody's making a mechanical life, you assume it's going to live longer than a human being. It seems to have lived, you know,
what happened
less.
To it?
I don't know. Goethe saw it and said it was an appalling creature with a serious digestive problem. There was a photograph of it looking very ragged, which I saw. But when I started to research it, and I talked to this wonderful conservator at the V&A in London, and she didn't know, couldn't find anything about it. But she said to me, "Well, you know, have you seen the Silver Swan?" And she described what I used in the end, and this beautiful bird. And I said, "Well, have you got photographs of it? How can I find out about it? The plans?" And she said, "Oh, it's easier than that. Just go to YouTube and type in Silver Swan." And here was this glorious, glorious thing. So having gone, had my character, Henry, setting off to Europe to have a duck made, and I thought, well, I'm not going to give that up because it's too funny and it's too sweet. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is he'll set off to have the duck made and he'll meet some sort of willful, the person who actually makes it will be a willful, opinionated, driven maniac who really only wants to make a swan.
He's such a crazy. I wonder if you've based him on someone. Are you getting revenge there?
No, I'm completely sympathetic towards him. And he has the sort of mad, willful arrogance of a slightly out of control artist. Really, I was thinking of. I'm just trying to think. There's a Renaissance artist, Benvenuto Cellini,
yes,
who wrote an autobiography, you know, or a memoir. And I think I was thinking of him because he's sort of rather like that, you know, mad, willful sort of person who's full of attitude and invention.
The other thing, of course, is that your protagonist Catherine's going through a deep personal tragedy. And so interwoven into this is sort of this recovery that she's going through. She's been given this project to do, which at first she hates.
Well,
then it slowly gets to her, doesn't it?
Yes,
it does. Well, I mean, she restores things, you know, for a living, and she's always found automata pretty creepy anyway. And the notion that she should, at the very moment when she's mourning her lover, be given the task of recreating a life, she finds particularly offensive. And, you know, the story, her story, which I did lift from life, not from somebody I know, but from somebody I heard about, is, you know, that she's been having an affair for 13 years, somebody she really loves, the guy's married, has two kids. No one in the world, except we discover one person, knows there's been an affair. So she can't even grieve in public, you know, because that would be to expose it all. And Catherine in this situation is filled with grief and upset. And she's sort of angry. And
she does a lot of self-medication, doesn't she?
She puts a little bit away. Yes, she certainly does. That sort of aspect of her character I really, really loved. It's been an educational process for me to sort of discover that who was comfortable with angry women and who wasn't. I mean, for instance, you know, Claire Massoud's just got a wonderful book out with The Woman Upstairs, I think, which has got a wildly angry woman. And it's so fantastic. But I think there are some people who maybe they're more guys than women, who sort of get up. It's wrong for the woman to be angry. And anyway, Catherine is an angry woman, but I think she's full of life, and I think she's funny and reckless and a little nutty. But she's great.
Well, we don't know whether she was angry before, because we only joined the story where she's actually lost her lover. All of that could just be a grief reaction, couldn't it?
Yeah, and for myself, I think I didn't have to ask myself that question, you know. But she was probably inclined to have a clear... her relationship with her lover, with Matthew, does not seem to have been marked by anger at all. And I think that's probably true. She's not essentially an angry person.
Let's talk a little bit about just how long it took to actually put this book together, because I'm always interested in just how much research authors put into their work. So, you know, was it a couple of years of research to prepare for this one?
No. The great answer, you know, E.L. Doctorow has this great question when people say, how much research did you do, Mr. Doctorow? And he says, less than you'd think. And that's sort of true in a way, because you... could not ever, you could spend a lifetime really researching that whole world and still not have it right. So you've really got to find the corners and parts of it that you know. Mm. I spent a lot of time. I would, in that particular case, I tell you the truth, I can't really quite remember the sequence, but I started with things. I was talking to the woman at the V&A before I started to write it. And then I was talking to her again after I'd started to write it. And I knew that little bit of London where I have an annex, which is she's sent to work in at the back of Olympia. And I knew that bit of London a little bit, but I had a young writer who I knew in London where I gave him some very specific questions about the streets and the colours and the traffic and the sort of vans that are on the street. And as I was writing it, he gave me way more detail than I needed. But so I had the... when she goes in to her museum to work, I had, you know, what was on the floor, what were on the walls, what it smelt like. You know, there was an extractor fan and a fume cupboard. All of these things came from little specks taken, you know, grains taken out of, you know, 100 pounds of research. So.
Well, the back rooms of a place like a museum are vastly more fascinating, aren't they? I've worked in the back rooms of the Australian Museum, for instance, and there's whole bits there that the public never guess about. And, of course, the people who work in them have all these sort of little different rituals and, you know, proprietary areas, yes, and things like this that you've got to walk around,
yes,
and things
absolutely.
Like that as well, you know.
Absolutely.
So all of that, I would assume, came into it. Thank you for talking to us this morning,
it's
Peter.
It's been fun. Thank you very
it's
much.
Been wonderful. We wish you the best of luck with The Chemistry of Tears and, yes, all future projects as well.
Thank you so much.